a most original and creative talent in our business. Would you welcome Mr. Orson Welles?
Ladies and gentlemen, Orson Welles again, come to call for another visit.
Good evening. This is Orson Welles.
Buck Benny, the two-fisted, quick-triggered marksman who shoots from the hip and never misses.
Well, hello again. This is Buck Benny speaking. I'm joined with our Orson Welles ultimate historian, Vincent, not to build it up too far, but hey. And we have Catherine Fuller-Seeley, historian, Jack Benny specialist, and just an all-around great gal. And we have Terry, and Terry Phillips is our Imaginaire Theater man. And if you get a chance to listen to his shows on imaginairetheater.com, it's wonderful. And he's got a science fiction one coming up that he's working on, and we did a Western one not too long ago that is just wonderful and just a delightful listen to join and be part of that. But let's get started with Orson. So this episode of Orson, boy, I feel like I say this every week, but just every one is just blows my mind, but this one completely blew me away. There's two letters that are featured in this. Both of them impactful. Both of them we need to talk about. The first one struck me that I was like, my gosh, you can change a word or two and it would totally work today. I mean, it would not surprise anybody. If they heard that today, somebody reading that as though it was today, they would just go, oh yeah, that's true right now. The one that I think the part of it that's kind of humorous is they were talking about, I don't know if it was minimum wage or whatever, but it felt like minimum wage is what they were saying, was $15.80 a week was what the was pointed out. And now of course we're hearing in the news all the time about the trying to get up to $15 an hour for minimum wage. But it just shows times change. But everything else stayed about the same. And then the second letter we'll get into was delightful in that the first, I mean, it's a double, it's like a twist. And so many times these Orsons have a twist. It's essentially the beginning of it is saying how delightful it is that they had a black family appear in a magazine, and it wasn't focused on, oh, this is a black family. It was focused on just what the article or what it was about. And it happened to have a black family on it. And I thought, to me, it tied in so well to today in that our first viewings of it, like interracial couples and things on television, were in commercials. And commercials are definitely, you see homosexual couples portrayed in commercials now and things. Commercials, I didn't think would push the bounds of things, but they do, and they have apparently for years. Articles, commercials, all that sort of thing have pushed the bounds of things. And then it flips, and the person who is in the actual article or whatever has a secondary piece where they write and they talk about, well, maybe I missed my opportunity. We sort of were presenting it, hey, this happens to be a black family, but going through some of the same things that you're going through, right? But then it became, well, maybe I should have focused more on what's happening to black people in America, and that this isn't the normal story. The normal story is that they're really struggling and really having issues, and it goes all into that. Just unbelievably good episode. Let's go to our friend Terry, since I've gone to him last, I feel like, lately. So Terry, what were your kind of takeaways on this and things? Because I do forgive him for saying Rod Serling can't act, and so here we go. Let's go, Terry.
I think it's fair to say that more than being, unlike Rod Serling, a great actor, and more than being a great director and a creative force in general, that Orson Welles was a champion of social justice. He was ahead of his time, both in the topics he took on and his courage in addressing, in ways that were oftentimes not the mainstream, and oftentimes, as became the case in the few years following these commentaries, dangerous, actually dangerous. I was reading an article earlier this week about book banning in America. And I was thinking, oh yeah, you know, back in the 1700s, 1800s, no, 1925, in my parents' lifetime, books were banned in the United States, and it was dangerous. People risked imprisonment and losing employment and so forth for reading certain things, for possessing certain things. And just the other night, I watched a film that was made five or so years ago about the life of Dalton Trumbo. It was called, coincidentally, Trumbo. It starred Bryan Cranston. And it was, if you haven't seen it, an extraordinary portrayal of blacklisting.
I would agree with that. Very good.
And Wells risked all of that and rose above it nevertheless. He lost his sponsorship, and that maybe had something to do with the audience response to the unpopular positions he took on these topics and the unpopular topics themselves, that Lear Radio eventually decided not to renew his sponsorship. And I was reading that he had been paid by the Lear Company $1,700 an episode to do these when he lost his sponsorship. And by the way, even though he didn't mention it, they were still paying up to this point. I think they dropped it in October or something like that. But he wasn't mentioning the name of the sponsor. Maybe they were in contract negotiation. I don't know why he didn't say who was paying him. But when he lost the sponsorship, he went from getting $1,700 an episode to $50 an episode. And yet he soldiered on because he cared that much about the things he said. And you have to admire him for that.
Well, and he does mention in this episode, I think it's this one that where he mentions that it actually has hurt him financially, some of his positions and
that's
things.
Right.
Yeah. Right. He says no one will hire.
That's right.
Yeah.
And I mean, Mercury Theater suffered, he said, as a result of it.
That's true.
It is true.
This is the most he said about it anywhere that I can think of. And it was short. I mean, he didn't mention it much. Because he didn't want to focus on himself, I think, but he did mention it, and so I thought it was interesting in this episode as well. Vincent, what are your thoughts on
that? I mean, I think that's totally true. I mean, but you also need to remember that he's not exactly at this point in 1946 the most bankable commodity anyway. You know, he, for example, meanwhile he's doing these
which
radio
is humorous for Vincent, which is humorous just in the fact that just a few years earlier. He's doing Mercury Theater, which is just goes through the roof and does its amazing things. And he does Citizen Kane, you know, and this is like just 5 years after Citizen Kane. And Citizen Kane is like this amazing film. Everyone agrees it's just insanely well done. And yet now he's washed up or whatever. But go ahead, Vincent.
Yeah, no, it's true. I mean, you know, at the time, a lot of people didn't think Citizen Kane was all that amazing is the other thing to remember. Yeah. But you know, he also was, you know, cast as a spendthrift, for example, that he couldn't finish movies. You know, he had these problems with RKO. In 1945, he made The Stranger, which was, you know, his most conventional film, perhaps at the time period, still not that conventional and not that successful either. So, you know, he's having a hard time finding work. While he's doing these commentaries, during the day, he's actually running the rehearsals for a Broadway musical around the world, which is, you know, completely opposite in terms of tone than these commentaries. It's sort of a big sort of campy production that he put together with Cole Porter. But he had a hard time financing it. The same thing. I thought the same thing when he was talking about his sponsors. He couldn't find anybody who wanted to support him. He had to finance it himself largely. He had a couple sort of financiers, including Cole Porter. But, you know, he literally his chauffeur put in money for him to make this production. So it's not that Wells, you know, it's not just his political crusading, which I think is really admirable and you know, you can see his momentum building, which will eventually allow, you know, encourage him, I think, to take on police brutality. But yeah, we should remember that he's rehearsing in like a decrepit, an opera house that's no longer doing operas alongside like boxing because they couldn't pay anywhere else to rehearse. So that's what made me think. He's saying it's all about politics. I think he's a sort of overplaying politics here a little bit in that sense.
Yeah.
Well,
That's amazing. Well, this, like the previous episode, it's like such a fascinating encapsulation of the hot button issues in 1946 from who's going to control, you know, and he throws them all in here in 15 minutes, but between who's going to control the atom, how's the UNO going along, Gromyko's walking out, the Russians are after oil, you know, I mean, so that, you know, pointing out that the Cold War has really started over oil. We usually say it started over ideological communism, but it's great that he's also focusing on the sort of economic power play going on at the same time. And then to move from now, I've got to go find this issue of American Home to look at that, to find that article, but then also to because in it to talk about the housing crunch. And the inequalities of housing, because it previously he's been talking about returning veterans have no place to live. And, you know, and to talk about here the terrible slums of Harlem, which now nobody can afford to live in Harlem anymore. But like I said, all this stuff going on back then is it just to say that 1946 is such an incredible time. As I said, my undergraduates like to think, well, we won World War II, we're just going to Disney World. But to say that it's unleashed all these tremendous number of issues that people had to be dealing with, and for him to put them all out there is fascinating.
Well, the biggest, to me, the most interesting piece of this, just one sentence or whatever that's in this whole thing, is not anything Orson says. It's something that the person who was in the article shares. And it's how tightly packed folks are in Harlem and that area. And he says, if you did the same thing across the United States, that the entire population of the United States would be in, what does he say? Is it New York?
Half of Manhattan, or think is what he says.
Yeah.
Something like that.
And I'm thinking, can that be accurate? I don't know, but man, that's crazy to think of how packed in folks were, and then how few people there truly are across the country, and at least back then, and still where we have these huge swaths of the country where very few people live.
New Yorkers often say that there are some states that have a population that is smaller than their building.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's true still, probably.
And well, but also going on, the slums of New York were also still really crammed, you know, into the Lower East Side, into Harlem. Most of Long Island was still potato farms. So, you know, I mean, if we, you know, and you could, if you had a job in Manhattan, scrubbing somebody's floors, you know, I mean, so there weren't too many options. Nobody had been building apartment houses, and there wasn't much government, you know, I mean, most of the government housing didn't get started until after World War II. So there literally were very few places to live. And so people were really crammed into these slums. So,
well, and a piece of this, and this comes up over and over on the Orsons, but the fact that on radio at the time, because I've listened to a lot of radio that's out there at the time, you didn't have a lot of voice of the Black American and what they were going through at the time and things. This is, you don't hear, of course, it's, you don't get the actual person on the show, but you get something they've written being presented by Orson, and you truly can get a viewpoint of that you're not used to getting, which is the viewpoint of the African American and their plight in this time and frame in 1946. And I think that piece alone makes this totally worth listening. And then, the first piece is so interesting because it's someone wrestling with, when you get older, should you just let things slide, or should you? And Orson, he picks letters that are well written and then usually can trump them with his response to that letter, which you're going when he reads the letter, you're like, wow, that's really good, you know, and then for him to come up with something equally good or better, it's like, wow, It's just,
I have a question about these commentaries. As he talked increasingly about the rights of African Americans, do any of you know whether these commentaries were dropped by stations in the South? It was on ABC's network, and I presume they
had. That's a great point. I'll go look this week. Yeah. I'll look this afternoon just because that's the kind of thing that really interests me. I'll go check, say, the Atlanta paper and the Richmond paper and see if it's still there. So,
because as we know, it happened in television quite often.
Yeah.
The program.
Yeah.
Movies too.
It would surprise me if they weren't dropped. It would surprise me. Yeah. I would think that a whole bunch of the Southern stations and things would have stopped carrying this a long time ago. Maybe aired the first four or five episodes and we're out.
That's really interesting. I'll go look at that. So,
and it would be an easy thing for them to slide out of. It wouldn't be like trying to slide out of Amos and Andy or anything like that. I mean, this is a little 15 minute commentary thing that they could just go, oh, we just don't have time to air it. We're not going to do that.
Yeah. On the third station, you know, this is ABC. This is NBC Blue now sort of scuttling along.
That's true. You
know, the whole network. So,
yeah.
But that's a great question. So,
yeah. It's equivalent to DUM in the 1950s on television. It was like, yeah, not going to last long.
Yeah. Vincent, I'm just curious, when you've been to see Orson Welles's papers, now, of course, you weren't looking for anything like this, but did he tend to keep, you know, all this stuff? Might there be things at Indiana? Because I guess it's them, the Lilly Library, that is digitized, these recordings. I was just curious, you know, if in general, was Orson one to document his own history a lot?
Yeah, so there's two main archives. One is in Indiana where the recordings are, and they have a lot of letters. The other one is at my home institution, the University of Michigan, where we have the largest collection of primary sources on Orson Welles. So come to Ann Arbor, go to Bloomington. I wasn't particularly looking for this, and he kept a lot of stuff, but it's like any archive, it's sort of hodgepodge. You never know what he saved. Some letter collections are really well saved. For example, the letters written to him about War of the Worlds. I have been in a project for a couple of years where we've been digitizing all of those letters, transcribing them. That should be available this October. So go look for them. They're fantastic. They're like the most interesting, as if the internet was around in 1938, and it's all the comments, basically. That's how I like to think of the letters. They're awesome. These letters, I've never seen any proof of them. I'm sure they existed. He didn't keep them like War of the Worlds, as far as I know. But as we talked about, they seem like he's either picking the cream of the crop, or he's just the way he's delivering them make them seem like, I mean, he wrote them, or it's like, you know, Shakespeare wrote them or something. And they're just beautiful. Yeah. They're far more beautiful than the average, fan letter from the time period, certainly, at least given the War of the Worlds. And that's, go ahead.
He does mention that he got thousands and thousands of letters. So he would have a lot to choose from. If he's telling the truth and he did get thousands of letters, then.
And if not, it sounds good and suing, right?
So. Yeah.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Well, it also makes you wonder, did he read these and go, I'm sure when she wrote this or he wrote this, they would have liked me to punch it up a little bit, and you don't know.
Well, that's going to come into play with our next Orson broadcast. Yes. Who could have written that much on the back of time slips? So
yeah. I'm very suspect of that letter. These letters I'm less suspect of, I will say. I mean, the first thing I want to say about the, where he talks about the sickness of age, I played that for like every one of my friends. I generally never do that, but I thought this is so universal seemingly that, you know, it sort of encapsulates, you know, just every sort of movement that we have going on now. And it seemed so timeless.
We all do, like we share these with our friends and things. You'll find that it's okay will still be your friends even after they're gone because you've shared this with them and forced them to listen to this.
That's my fear. You got it exactly right.
I only have the three of you now, so just the way it is. And John occasionally is my friend, but that's about it. Anyway, Vincey, you were going to say.
That's awesome. Yeah, the other letter I think is, I mean, it's truly heartbreaking. Even the part of it which seems like a celebration where this gentleman who's writing is saying that, you know, for one moment I wanted to enjoy the luxury of just being an American. And that's what that, you know, in his eyes, that advertisement represented. I'm just a normal person living in a house who's worried about, you know, having nicer furniture. But the sad reality then, and you know, unfortunately not that different from now, is that he essentially says, I realized when my friend wrote to me, my next door neighbor wrote to me and said, my apartment is actually trashed. It's, you know, the roof is falling in, that I'm not just like every other American. And in fact, I don't have the luxury of doing that. And so then he writes this beautiful letter, sadly beautiful, that's saying, here's actually the reality. I did you a disservice by showing you this sort of luxurious life that I appeared to be living. It actually, to me, made me think of a lot of those, like a lot of people put that on Twitter, or especially women working from home, where they would be like, you know, they had their office looked awesome and everything looked great. And then they would show a picture of like actually what their life was like. They had kids running everywhere. And sort of this letter writer is doing the same thing and saying, you know, life for a Black American in Harlem doesn't look like this. It actually looks a lot like this. And we're kept this way because of covenants. We're kept this way because of the crisis, because of the slums. And so if I'm ever going to live in this life of luxury, which I showed you, all of these things are going to have to be fixed. And they're not just, you know, fixed through an advertisement. And so I thought, it was, all of it was disturbing in sort of, even though it was poetic and beautiful, given Orson's sort of delivery and the writing. But
isn't that how so many of these are? These Orson commentaries, for those of us who've been here a long time and gone through a lot of these, they are amazing, well put together, and yet so often horrifying at the same time. There's just nothing quite like these. And I'm so glad Vincent has joined us and is going to hopefully continue to join us on doing this. Terry, I feel like I maybe cut you off at some point. Did you have anything more to talk about with this, or you're pretty good?
No, I'm looking forward to the crescendo as these things continue. I haven't obviously heard all of the rest of them yet, but if this trajectory of his commentaries continues, I can only guess at how much more powerful they will become over time.
Yeah, and we shall see. And we're just, I'm so thankful for, where do these come from again, guys? You said Indiana.
Yeah, the recordings are from Indiana. Yep.
Yep.
And Indiana, and the Lilly Library.
Yeah, just the fact that they had these, and it's so easy. I know I've talked about, my listeners will know, we know where like all the Fred Allen shows are, and there's no way to get to them. And there's so many out there that are luckily still, they still exist, a lot of recordings, but they're not made where the public can easily access them. For 75 years, there were 11 of these that you could get to, give or take. And now we can get to all of them thanks to the preservation of these, and the sound quality of these is so delightful. This episode is wonderful. And the clarity, just, I would not have believed that these could exist with this kind of quality and that they would have so many of these episodes available. And we get a chance to talk about, instead of talking about 11 shows, we get a chance to talk about, you know, 70 of them or 60 of them or whatever exists.
Wow.
It's a lot. So we're just scratching the surface of this as we keep going. And every week is a revelation. And Orson is pushing himself, and you can just feel it every few weeks. There's a lurch forward into the way he's presenting and the comfort level he has. I think jettisoning his sponsor, it certainly wasn't his choice or whatever, but it was necessary in some ways for him to be able to get to that next level that he couldn't have gotten to had he had a sponsor show.
Sure. So, he didn't, well, undoubtedly being on a network at all he still has to hold his tongue and somebody has to approve the scripts. So he can't, you know, I mean, somebody's got, there's continuity. Somebody's got to approve the scripts, but he doesn't also have to go through the hurdle of having the sponsor and its ad agency also approve the scripts. Right. So,
yeah, agreed. Okay. Well, let's stop there and enjoy this wonderful episode of Orson Welles. Like I say, one of my absolute favorites. And next week, we're going to bring you one that's equally good in a different way and just delightful. And I love that one as well. These were two of my favorites. So enjoy. We'll see you guys next time.
What you hear is that old time bomb still ticking the time away. But this week's good word of a program for controlling the atom and the good chance your letters to Washington have given us to keep that control away from the military give us the right, I think, to turn off our little sound effect a little earlier than usual this bright Sunday morning. Orson Welles speaking, bringing you 15 minutes worth of one man's opinion. I don't make a specialty of rumors, but I hear from Washington that Secretary of State Jimmy Burns is back in the good graces of Admiral Leahy and company. It's no secret the boys were after his scalp, and I happen to know that General Marshall was up for the job. Incidentally, Marshall is definitely coming back from China right away. Since Mr. Burns broke half the rules of parliamentary procedure in Hunter College last week, running the UNO meeting at times like the ringmaster of a circus, the Get Tough with Russia gang have decided they want him to stay right where he is. Mr. Burns is presently being described as a great statesman, but the formula he's being praised for was something Mr. Hodgson of Australia wanted to present earlier, but the motion wasn't put, so Mr. Hodgson doesn't get the credit for being a statesman. Mr. Burns didn't give him the chance. When Gromyko took his walk, he was only refusing to talk about Iran before April 10th. The good news, for what it's worth, is that Russia did not apply the veto to discussion. Note, up to here, Britain and America put a kind of veto on discussion of another matter, the tyranny in Franco-Spain. Poland breaks the silence now. We shall see what we shall see. Well, we had Gromyko's word for it that the Iranian question wasn't a question at all, and I don't think it was much of a question at that. Burns insisted on the right of Iran to come before the council and have its say. Gromyko wanted the subject postponed, claimed it wasn't fit to discuss anyway. Looks like Gromyko was right about that, but the principle is wrong that it's up to a big power to decide whether a small nation has a case against it or not. If UNO is going to make any moral sense at all, then of course its members must all have the chance to air their complaints, real or fancied or trumped up. Gromyko asked for a short delay, a perfectly fair request. If he'd shown reasons for it, he couldn't or didn't choose to offer such reasons, and that was the main weakness of his argument. Oil. None of the delegates have been heard to speak the nasty word, but as I've said here before and here all along, oil is the core of the crisis. Russia wants transit rights to the Persian Gulf. Russia wants to secure her borders with the buffer state of Azerbaijan. But what Russia wants most from Iran isn't friendship or a way to the sea. Russia wants oil. Russia has oil of her own, plenty of oil. Plenty for peace, but not enough for war. That sounds pretty grim, and it is. Russia wants oil for war. You can't laugh that one off. But you can jump to conclusions, the wrong conclusions. Because Russia wants oil for war, it does not follow that Russia wants war. No, Russia wants peace as much as we do, if possible, even more. But according to communist doctrine, capitalist powers can't keep the peace. We don't want war, but we don't trust Russia. These international arguments start and finish with that mutual suspicion. Everybody wants peace, and nobody believes in it. The man who died a year ago next Friday once told us that we have nothing to fear but fear itself. We're learning a bitter lesson, as it was here at home, so it is among the nations. Fear is something to be afraid of. When you listeners have written me on almost every subject in the world, I've had letters of complaint and encouragement by the thousands, questions and suggestions, anecdotes and editorials, and for some time now I've made it a practice to put at least one of your letters on the air each week. A maker of fine radios has given me the chance to repay you for your trouble by sending you a radio for the letters I use. Lately, I've fallen a little in arrear, so today we'll have two letters and catch up. The first is from Seattle, Washington. Dear Mr. Welles, I'd like to entitle this The Death of a Liberal. or something dramatic like that, but actually isn't that bad. However, I do find myself, along with a lot of other young people, being pushed from the left, politically speaking, to the right. This is known in polite circles as growing up or adjusting to things as they are. I happen to dislike things the way they are. I think too many people get a raw deal. I don't like to read about Negroes who were turned away from state universities or made to sit in the rear of buses. I don't like to hear about the worker who tries to support her five children on a take-home pay of $15.80 a week and is considered greedy for asking for more. I find that I'm in favor of racial equality and a higher standard of living for everyone. Is there anything radical about that? If you don't think so, Mr. Wells, drop in on the local matrons at the next tea when I happen to say a good word for unions or fair employment legislation, and I fear it's much worse at the businessmen's lunch meeting. It seems that the older and supposedly wiser generation is shocked by every progressive idea that is advanced. If we're going to get along with them and make desirable social contacts, we shall either have to muzzle ourselves or become staunch defenders of the status quo. At times it appears there's no choice. Yours very truly, Beth F. Carter. Dear Miss Carter, I know just how you feel. All of us on the progressive side of the argument get discouraged sometimes. Sure, it's easier to drift with the wind, let things go as they are, to keep the friendship and esteem of all the cautious-minded folk, and to leave the hard work of reform to the other fellow. It's much easier to stay neutral in the war between injustice and democracy. Nobody at the matron's tea or the businessman's luncheon table blames you for not voting. Does look as though you can't get hurt if you stay out of the fight. But the truth is, you can't stay out of the fight. You don't want to, or you wouldn't have written me as you did. Anyway, it isn't a matter of choice. Whether they know it or not, everybody's in this fight. And the more you try to stay out of it, the better your chances are of getting hurt. The old battle between evil and good is still raging, and there's no such thing as a non-combatant. Of course, it's always easy to give advice. It's easy for me to tell you to stay in the fight, but believe me, Miss Beth Carter, I am not speaking from any special fortress of personal safety. I don't get to speak out on these questions for free. Free speech costs money, costs me a lot of money. I'm very grateful for the opportunity I've been given in the press and on the radio to speak my mind. I make no complaint of the fact that speaking my mind has brought me often real financial embarrassment. You know, many radio programs I used to work on have ceased to hire me since I've been using the radio so outspokenly. I've been trying, for instance, to sell the Mercury Theater for a limited series of broadcasts reviving our best shows of other years. And since your obedient servant has become one of those things known as a controversial figure, the Mercury has had to put its price down to go on the market at all. Last week, we thought we had a sponsor, but at the last moment, he started worrying about how controversial I am and the project collapsed. Now, I'm being very frank only to show you that you're not alone. I'm not asking you to think of me as some kind of martyred hero. I'm no hero at all. I'm far from being martyred. I'm one of the luckiest and most overpaid men in the world. I'd just like you to see that I really do appreciate your problem. You are very young, Miss Carter, and I am not as young as I was, so I have a right to tell you that wanting to change the world is not a sickness of youth. On the contrary, not wanting to change the world is the sickness of age. The world is always changing for better or for worse. The world is always moving, but if we left all the moving to the old folks, we'd move only backwards. I happen, you say, to dislike things the way they are. Good for you. You'll be called a crank and a malcontent, but really, you're a lover of life. The lover of life always hates things as they are. That's part of the celebration of that love. The celebration itself is the occupation of youth. To participate is the sign of youth. I've known men and women with almost a century of years behind them who are participants. It's the old who fear death, the old in spirit. And it's only these who like things as they are. They'll settle for any kind of world just so they can stay in it. That's what it means to be a Tory. To be a Tory is to be old. To be a Tory is to fear death so much that you prefer mere survival to life itself. No, Miss Carter, don't let him kid you. Adjusting to things as they are is not maturity, it is collaboration. Giving up is not growing up. If we are to make desirable social contacts, you say, we shall either have to muzzle ourselves or become staunch defenders of the status quo. Miss Carter, What, if you please, is a desirable social contact? You'll have to decide what company you want to keep. Do you want to be friends with the living or the dead? You can't have it both ways. It's true enough, of course, that those in decay can be very dear to our hearts. It's not a happy choice, I know. Some of my best friends are corpses. When you bring up the Negro question, Miss Carter, and this brings me to another letter, a letter from a citizen called Earl Snyder. Mr. Sidner wrote for a magazine. I wrote a column for the newspapers about Mr. Sidner's article. And in order to explain this, I'll have to quote from my column first of all. It goes like this. Maybe we shouldn't mention a certain piece in a periodical called The American Home, but we're going to. It's a run-of-the-mill layout. Quote, they put the difference into war bonds, unquote, reads the caption. It's been done and done, you know, by a dozen similar magazines. Just pictures of newlyweds in their bright little home. The pose is perfectly traditional, but the young wife and her husband are Negroes. This is announced only by the fact of the photographs. The text is about how to save money by building your own furniture. That's all. Had this been a discussion of Negro housing, had it suggested, however elliptically, that Negroes do not necessarily keep their coal in the bathtub, the article would have been guilty of that error the well-intentioned majority tends to make in its relationships with the minority peoples. We look forward to the day when such items as the one we've called attention to are the rule, not the exception, and when such columns as this will be superfluous. Until then, we submit that the American Home magazine should be very proud of its May issue. That's as far as my column went on the subject, and now comes Mr. Sidner's letter. Dear Mr. Wells, he writes, in a newspaper column, you complimented the American Home magazine for publishing an article with pictures of a couple in their bright little home without once mentioning the caption or context, except for the pictures that the couple were Negroes. Well, we were very pleased with your comment, Mr. Wells, for I was the author, and those pictures were of my wife, Virginia, and me. A neighbor of ours had sent us your clipping in a letter to California, where I was then stationed, and Virginia was visiting me there at the time. Then I read our neighbor's letter. I began to wonder. I wondered if my article should not have been on Negro housing. Wondered if I'd not missed an opportunity to tell them that the American home therein pictured was not only a show of resourcefulness in the face of wartime shortages and high prices, but a victory over the slums. Mr. Wells, have you ever seen the slums stalk a house, a neighborhood, or even a whole side of town? All around the slums, with its cold, damp, musty earth smell, sits like a death watch, poking a finger through the plaster here, a rat hole there, getting a foothold in the loose bricks, ready to move in. And once in, there's no dispossessing. The kids of the neighborhood seem to know when a house has been conquered by the slums long before the city fathers reluctantly condemn it for further human inhabitants. At last, the last family has moved out to double up with a relative or a friend, and then the kids from the block take over. They seem to want to punish the old house for having given up the struggle, so they break the remaining windows. They race through the dark, deserted halls playing cops and robbers. They corner their quarry in a room. And though the door is still there on one hinge, they prefer to break through the crumbling walls and bring out their man dead or alive, just like the movies. They make their fun for this in the streets of the playground for the children of the slums, and this is the breeder of crime, and this is the breeder of disease. Finally, one of the kids breaks a leg in the old house, so the roof falls in, and then the city fathers come and seal up the door and broken windows. Now there's one less place to play, and one less house for the families of the ghetto. Mr. Wells, we live in that Harlem ghetto where substandard houses, overcrowded conditions, and sky-high rents are the order of the day. There is one single block in Harlem in which 3,871 people live. A similar density for all the United States population would result in the whole of America's population living in one half of New York City. This is the ghetto, Mr. Wells, and the wall is all around us, high with covenants and unwritten codes of restrictions. In that American Home article, I was a husband of limited means with a new wife, and I wanted to share my solution to the furniture problem with other husbands in the same plight. So for a moment, I indulged in the luxury of just being an American. But that letter from my neighbor focused the picture into painful sharpness. Dear Earl and Virginia, it read, the roof over your apartment is leaking again this year. The rain must be pouring in through in torrents, for even as far as two floors directly below you, the plaster is falling from the walls as a result. So send me the keys to your apartment. I'll look in and advise you of the damage done your little place so beautifully pictured in this month's issue of The American Home. Yours very truly, Earl Sidner. Mr. Sidner and Miss Carter get a radio with my thanks. And my thanks to you for listening. Please let me come to call the same time next week. Until then, I remain, as always, obediently yours.
This is ABC, the American Broadcasting Company.